today, thus far, is Representative Moses, Representative Holm, myself, Co-Chairman Meyer, Representative Petula, Representative Hucker, and Representative Weira. On today's schedule, we have four bills, House Bill 446, House Bill 377, House Bill 312, and House Bill 478. If there's anything to come before the committee, Chair would entertain that now. Otherwise, we'll go ahead and get started on the first bill, which is House Bill 446. And also want to welcome Co-Chairman Chenault. House Bill 446, we should have Mr. Johnson here to introduce us to the bill, tell us what the bill is about. He is speaking on behalf of the sponsor, Representative McGuire, who's going to be with us next week, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think that is, she'll be back doing business on that.
Very good.
We're looking forward to that.
Yes, we are.
We are too.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you for an opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Greg Johnson, staff to Representative McGuire. HB 446 is a bill which basically is a consumer protection bill. The Federal Trade Commission recently reported that Alaska was tops in the nation for consumer protection report for last year, with 249 per 100,000 people making us the number one complainant in the nation. HB 466 seeks to increase the civil penalties under Alaska's Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act. Under the current law, when a person or a company violates an injunction prohibiting an unfair act, they're subject to a maximum fine of $25,000. HB 446 would increase that to $50,000. The act also provides for a $5,000 civil penalty. The current penalties under this bill, under the law, were instituted when this bill was created in 1970. There have been no increases. And basically what we're doing is putting some teeth into the Consumer Protection Act, allowing the department to hopefully not be number one in consumer protection complaints in the future. With that, I have Ed Sniffen, who is with the Consumer Protection Division, online to answer any questions. Also have Ted Popley, legal counsel, here to answer any of the legalese that might be necessary. I guess in closing, the only thing I would say is that all this bill basically does is adjust it for inflation, takes that 1970 number, and does bring it into the today's number. So that's the basis of the bill, basic consumer protection.
Okay. Very good. Before we get started here on questions, I want to welcome Representative Kelly, Vice Chairman Stoltz, and Representative Jewell. Any questions for the sponsor? Okay, seeing none. Bill does seem to be pretty self-explanatory. Is there anybody online to testify? No. If it's online for questions, okay. We'll go ahead and close public testimony. Any amendments?
I don't need questions. I'd be asking.
Okay, no amendments, no questions.
Would you like one, Mr. Chairman?
Question? No, you don't have to.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, could you explain the rationale of dropping the present $5,000 civil penalty for each violation to a new violation would be between $1,000 and $25,000? Is there any reason you would lower it less than five? Even though you're raising it to 25.
Mr. Co-Chair, I think Mr. Sniffen would be better to answer that. A lot of these suggestions came actually from the department, and I would call on him to answer the rationale to that question.
Okay, Mr. Sniffen.
Yes, Chairman, can you hear me?
You're online, sir? We can't hear you.
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear
there you.
Okay.
We got it.
Did you hear the question, Mr.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law in Anchorage, and I work in the Consumer Protection Unit where I have been enforcing Alaska's Consumer Protection Act for 6 years. I believe the question was, is there any reason why we would seek penalties less than $5,000? Is that correct?
That's correct.
There are a number of cases that involve violations of our act that are not necessarily serious violations, but violations that still warrant some kind of penalty. For example, we might have a business in Anchorage that engages in some advertising violations. Not knowing that he's committed a violation, there has been relatively little consumer harm, but nonetheless, the practice is a violation of our Consumer Protection Act. In those types of cases, we work with the businesses to provide some meaningful penalty that might be less than $5,000, and then get the businesses to agree to change their practice so future violations don't occur. So there are cases where penalties less than $5,000, depending on the facts of the case, are warranted. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Parker has a question. Is this for Mr. Sniffen?
It may well be, okay. Mr. Chair, for the formal matter, as I'm looking at the fiscal notes on this bill, we've got 2-0 fiscal notes, including court system and Department of Law. The bill is providing a substantial increase in these particular penalties. I'm just as a pure technical matter, I'm surprised we don't have some fiscal note somewhere here that shows an increase in revenue, or do we expect this to be another bill that accomplishes nothing?
Through the chair, hopefully that the nature of this bill would be that it would be neutral because we need people to violate the law with these increased fines. So there's a possibility that it may in fact be a bill that does nothing, and when you're talking about consumer fraud, if you do nothing, that is a good thing.
Mr. Sniffen, where do these fines go? How are they accounted for, and then what department would be responsible for a fiscal note estimating a change in fines collected?
Through the chair, that's a good question. The funds that we collect through our civil penalty efforts in the Department of Law go one of two places. Either they go directly to the general fund, or in some circumstances, we earmark funds for use by our consumer protection agency for future consumer protection, education, and enforcement. The reason we can't identify a positive fiscal note is because we never really know on an annual basis what kind of activity we're going to engage in as far as consumer protection litigation. In some years, we get involved in a lot of multi-state cases with other states, and we prosecute pharmaceutical companies for violations, and satellite companies, and phone companies, and Microsoft, and others. And the resolution of those cases results in not really a windfall, but in some sense a large chunk of cash coming into the state's general fund. And in other years, we simply don't have any of those types of cases. We have smaller local cases against local businesses who are engaged in unfair trade practices. And it just depends on the conduct, whether or not we collect fines in those cases. But the money does go through the Department of Law into the state's general fund, and it's accounted for in that manner.
You know, what I heard in that long answer was that it might be more appropriate to, rather than have a zero change in revenues, have it be an indeterminate.
Through the chair, that may be appropriate. I'll have to leave that to our administrative department to to counsel me on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. And I would agree, Representative Hawker. I think indeterminate is a better fiscal note on this. Okay, any other questions, comments? Representative Hawker, do you want to make a motion to change that to indeterminate?
If you would like to handle it in that manner, Mr. Chairman.
Actually, I think that's a more accurate reflection of this bill.
And then, Mr. Chairman, if you would allow me to make a conceptual and verbal amendment here that would change the Department of Law's fiscal note from a blank or a zero change in revenues, but to an indeterminate for every fiscal year shown on the fiscal note.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, that amendment is accepted. Okay, any other questions or comments, amendments on the bill? If not, Representative Jewell.
You know, where there are determining fiscal notes, Mr. Chairman, is there a way that when we come back for the next year's budget cycle, that those indeterminate fiscal notes can, we can get some numbers put to them? Is that within the realm of possibility?
Representative Chenault.
I think that's probably in the outer space realm, if you want my first blush at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but we will look into it, Representative Jewell, and see if there isn't a way that we might be able to track some of those indeterminate notes to determine whether they were actually a positive or a negative cash flow. So I'll work on that with finance and see if we can't come up with something.
I just, you know, during the course of the year, we pass the handful of indeterminates, and I wonder sometimes what that means.
You never know what happens to you. Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Jewell. Okay, Chair would entertain a motion then to move this out of committee with the revised fiscal notes. Representative Stoltz.
Mr. Chair, I move that CS for House Bill number 46, Judiciary, be moved out of committee with the new House Finance Committee fiscal notes for the Department of Law and the court system, reflecting indeterminate fiscal notes, and that the bill be reflect the individual recommendation to members.
Let me just ask, was the intent both?
You know, Mr. Chair, I might, for the record,
go ahead.
At least it was my sense that the court system would not have been affected here because that's a fixed cost of a fixed state operation. Yes, sir.
So just amend that with the House Finance substitute for the Department of Law and 015 for the court system.
Okay. Very good. Any objections? Seeing none, bill passed out of committee. Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's go ahead and go to House Bill 377. let's see. Okay, yeah, this is a good bill.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
I believe Representative Foster wanted me to state this was the best bill he's ever seen.
Okay, very good. I appreciate that. Thank you for taking over that role for Mr. during Mr. Foster's absence. Okay, House Bill 377, presenting will be Mike Pulaski on my behalf. Mr. Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House Bill 377 was brought to the chairman's attention by a constituent involved in the home building industry. Essentially, what 377 does is look at the jurisdiction of the requirements for a design professional to prepare drawings or specifications for a building and adds an exemption to the existing listed exemptions that comports with the codes that have been adopted by the major municipalities like Fairbanks, Juneau, and Hancock. The idea behind it is that where the building codes apply and govern the design and construction of a building, that the securing of the services of an architect or engineer is unnecessary and that it adds an extra level of expense and cost and delay to a project. The home builders support the bill, and there is a zero fiscal note. Mr. Chairman, I'd answer any questions I can or if the members of the committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bosky. Now, I guess in all fairness here, the home builders do support this bill. We have met with the architects and engineers board, and there was no response from them, but there is a response from which group is it?
Mr. Chairman, I had heard that there was a new letter addressing the committee substitute. I have not seen that letter yet, but I understand it's the committee today.
Yeah, I think there's a March 14th letter from the Board of Registration for Architects and Engineers and Land Surveyors. Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I understand, and I'm sure they're hearing to speak to the concerns, concerns over safety. The other side of that, and there should be someone online to testify, I believe Mr. Taylor is online to testify. But the other side of that discussion has been that where there are building codes that affect and govern the construction, the standards for the construction of a residence, the securing of an architect or engineer should be unnecessary. Further, if you look at the exemptions that are currently in statute, they are for on page 2, line 19 and 20, a residence of four families not more than two stories high. The building codes, the International Building Code and the International Residential Code, talk about a building, and this is where we took the language in 21 and 2, of two families that is not more than three stories high. And that is the issue that we're talking about, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that when the building codes cover that you still have to go through a plan review process, you still have to submit something to get your building permit, and then you can go forward and build. And that's been a concern of the property board here.
Very good. Any questions at this time? Representative Taylor.
If you were trying to make it easier, why didn't you leave it at four families and three stories?
Representative Kelly, through the chairman, that was the way the original version was drafted. And the dilemma that came out in informal discussions with some architects and engineers was that, A, you weren't directly meeting what the code references, which is two families and three stories. And the other is that once you expanded beyond two families into the four families and three stories, you got into much bigger buildings than a duplex.
Okay.
And that change was made in the labor and commerce.
We do have a couple people who want to testify, and if you'll stay around for questions.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Very good. Let's go to Mark Morris. Are you, Mark? Okay. I wasn't sure if you were here or online.
Thank you. My name is Mark Morris. I'm a registered professional engineer and a member of the State Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. I've never testified before a legislative group like this before, and the fact that I'm now sitting in opposition to a bill sponsored by the chairman doesn't make it any easier.
Welcome to the world.
We as a board met in February, and we discussed this, and our board chairman drafted one letter dated February 24th, and that was based on when the exemption was going to cover four families, and when the exemption was modified to two families, the chair wrote a second letter dated March 14th, and we made these letters available to some folks right before the meeting, and hopefully you folks all have copies of these two letters before you. The board was unanimous in its position on this. There was no substantive debate amongst the board members, which represent the different engineering disciplines registered by the state, as well as the disciplines of architecture and land surveying, which doesn't fare. The reason why the board is opposed to this is because the issue here isn't the size of the structure. The issue is the height of the structure. And when you increase the height of a structure, the design loads increase exponentially. They don't increase by a third when you go from a two-story to a three-story structure. They increase much faster than that. Wind loads, seismic loads, radically modify what an architect or an engineer has to plan for. So, for example, if you go to a three-story structure and somebody wants to build a home with a lot of nice big picture windows, the structural engineer becomes very concerned because the amount of shear wall in the structure, the requirement for how much shear wall is in the structure goes way up, but there's not more wall to put it in. Shear wall keeps a house from crumpling when it's objected to a side load due to wind or due to seismic. So shear walls are basically plywood walls that aren't penetrated by big windows. So what will often happen on a home like that is that the structural engineer will put another wall in the house somewhere where somebody won't notice, like down a hallway, and then he'll put both sides of that wall on the steps. They'll put plywood and then put the sheetrock. So the homeowner has no idea, but his or her home is much stronger than it would be if it was just a conventionally built home with normal studs and wrapped it with plywood and put your windows in and go. So the problem with going to the third story and not having a registered professional do the design is that you don't have somebody running all those calculations. to make sure that the building materials that are being used and the nailing schedule and how much plywood and yada, yada, yada are all taken into consideration to handle the loads. We often go with sometimes more studs, so the studs aren't 16 inches on center, they might be 12 inches on center. Or we might go to a 3x4 stud instead of a 2x4 stud, or make the headers big above the windows. And a contractor is not going to be aware of what those requirements are going to be. They haven't been educated or trained as a group in those calculations and being able to do that. That doesn't mean that there aren't some contractors in the state who could safely build three-story homes and handle those issues, but the statute applies to all professionals in the state and all contractors. And so we as a board believe that this statute was created to protect the public safety, and we believe that that is being compromised with this exemption, and that's why the board is opposed to it.
Okay, very good. Representative Stoltz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have a ballpark? What's the typical cost of architecture, engineering services in the price of, say, a $200,000 home? Is there a general percentage that architectural and engineering services are factored in as a percentage, given a ballpark?
It's hard to say, because on a home like this, what we would typically do is, in other words, you wouldn't need an electrical engineer to handle something like this, or a mechanical engineer. So you would only need a structural engineer, and he would need to work with an architect. So it's a smaller percentage than it normally is. On a commercial building, you can typically figure somewhere between 6 to 8% of the cost of construction for professional services. On a home where you only need a couple of disciplines to handle the issues, it would be much less, like maybe 3% or something like that.
So on a $200,000 home, that's an extra $6,000 in construction costs.
Probably.
Minimum.
Just a complete wild guess.
This is a safety issue. I'm looking at some of the engineering. Now, when we build public buildings, we've had certainly some engineering architectural failures, just schools in my district that have been, frankly, embarrassments. And, I know a lot of good architects and engineers, but sometimes we've had local builders say, boy, I could tell they were doing this in a cockeyed way, and it's just, just because there's a license, I don't always have the profession. But you, I guess, just philosophically, if you had this, would you trade off the give us public safety and trade off the statute of repose as a have this requirement, but have a longer guarantee that you have to cover the to cover the responsibility, to give the consumer something more if you're going to be getting in on the skin game?
Could you rephrase that question for me?
Well, I don't know if this is a turf war or a public safety issue. It's just assuming that it is a public safety issue, and let's assume it's a public safety issue. We're looking out for the consumer's interest. If you want to make sure that they're going to be bearing the cost, the consumer, of that extra construction cost, would you be willing to give up some of the protections you have in the industry on the statute of repose that cuts your liability?
I'm going to have to plead ignorance, because I don't understand the statute that you're referring to. I'm an electrical engineer, and as a professional, I don't have anything to gain by this modification, one way or the other. But what I do understand about structural design issues, somebody would be foolish to build a home of three stories in any kind of seismic or wind loading area without having a professional look at it that understands how to do the calculations. So to me, it doesn't even pass the red face test. I mean, you need, when you go to three stories or more, you got to have somebody run some numbers for it.
So, Mr. Chairman, so the chairman's bill doesn't pass the public safety red face test? Is that what you...
in terms of designing or constructing three-story structures without having somebody look at them to make sure that those loads have been addressed. I'm not saying that somebody can't build a three-story home. My guess is that probably quite a few three-story homes built in our state that are doing just fine. But I think that for our profession, you want to make sure that you run those numbers and that the nailing schedule, that the shear walls are there, that the foundation size, that the basic structural elements of the home are strong enough to handle that.
That's fine for now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Very good. Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I share your anxiety at opposing the chairman's bill, but I am finding myself in that awkward position here at the moment. And believe me, I have much more to lose than you do this session. You are here, are you not, speaking on behalf of the state AELS board?
Yes, sir.
And again, you're a board that, we have this as a state. We've essentially entrusted you with administering this sort of thing in the state. I guess that's where I have a personal little of a conundrum here that I often ask the legislature to respect the guidance offered to us by the Board of Public Accountancy, another very exciting board. I think we've got really an obligation to give the board's desires great weight. But there is a question in here, and that is that statement from the Anchorage Home Builders Association, who, again, I've largely been pretty friendly to those folks, but in this one I'm having problems getting to this. They indicate that the state statute is a two-story and the international codes are three stories, implying they want to adopt some kind of international code. We've all been through code wars here, which is a whole different animal. Any way to comment on the applicability or the relevance of the argument that the international code at three stories is more appropriate than our current state statute?
No, I don't want to comment on exactly what the codes do or do not say. One thing that you need to make sure of is that codes are minimum standards for safety, and we all design all of the commercial buildings. Architects and engineers in the state only design commercial buildings. We don't do very much residential work, and for good reason, because you don't want to burden the home builder with the cost of these professional services when they're not warranted. But the codes are not designed as design manuals. They're designed as minimum measures of safety. And so taking out somebody with the knowledge of how to run the calculations to determine what the loads are on certain portions of the structure and then make sure that the materials used for that portion of the structure are adequate to handle the loads, that's not something that a code is designed to do. That's something that a design professional is educated to do and trained to do and tested in their application of to make sure that they do it properly.
Thank you.
Anything else? A couple questions, and then we'll move on to other testimony. It's my understanding now, if you build your own home, you can build to any standards. Is that correct?
It's my understanding under the statute that if you build a home to above this size, that you need to have a professional review the plans.
Well, my understanding is if you build your own home, you can build, these standards don't apply, but we can, I guess, argue that. And then, I think part of the problem was with the builders, there is a conflict. Again, the Anchorage Municipal Code, and I'm not sure if they're international or what they are, but currently they can build three stories without, it's my understanding, without having to get a architect, engineer's sign off on it. Is that your understanding also?
I'm not familiar with the Anchorage municipality's codes. I don't know that for a fact.
And I think in the valley, I don't know if they have any codes. Anyway, well, not yet. Well, Mr. Chairman, that the current mayor and the assembly try to copy Anchorage every day.
Okay. And then, let's see. And then I think, if I understand correctly, too, the state fire marshal only requires an engineer and architect only if the residence is more than three stories. So I think what we're trying to do here is just trying to get some consistency throughout the state.
That makes sense.
For the home builders who are building, you know, throughout the state. Why don't we, I think we do have somebody from the Home Builders Association to speak to this. And if you can stay around in case we do have more questions, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Orr.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Okay, let's see. Bill Taylor, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
I'm Bill Taylor. I'm representing the Anchorage Home Builders Association from the Builders Council, and I'm also a builder in Anchorage. And we view this as merely a housekeeping measure whereby we're tying the state statute to the International Residential Code and the International Builders Code. Right now there's an inconsistency, and all we're doing is cleaning up the language between the statute and the code. And very quickly on the safety issue, the way we interpret the change in the statute is that there will be no safety issue whatsoever, because all of the areas where the code does apply will have scrutiny or design review. For instance, in Anchorage, we'll have the plan review department of the municipality of Anchorage that will still review the plans for a three-story building. And it will comply with the code. There's no wind or seismic or loading issues whatsoever, because we still have to comply. It's not a safety issue in that respect. So I just wanted to clarify that. And that's all, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Ms. Taylor, would you have some questions? Representative Petula?
Thank you, and thanks for your testimony. So what you're saying is that the plans will be reviewed if it's going to be three stories, so that someone can say when you need the stress, I'm sorry, I'm not a builder, I'm not an architect, but so you have the kind of safety provisions that the gentleman who testified first was talking about. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. There will be scrutiny, and if a structure is deemed to be three stories, then it will go back to the plan review department and their plan review engineers for further scrutiny in case the foundation footing or the block has to be widened or increased in size, or if there are additional stud or stud sizes to be reviewed or increased in size. So yes, it won't just disappear into this void of non-review. We'll certainly be able to provide that level of scrutiny that the gentleman that was testifying before said that it lacked.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Representative Jewell has a question, Mr. Taylor.
Could you define three stories for me? I think I know what three stories are, but I see, is that three stories above ground?
Yes, it is. I'll just read the definition to you in the International Residential Code. It's anything that's more than 6 feet above the grade plane, or more than 6 feet above the finished ground level for more than 50% of the total building perimeter, or more than 12 feet above the finished ground level at any point. So there's three specific definitions that would apply to a three-story. If you meet any one of those three, then you have a three-story.
I heard every word you said. I'm not sure I understood any of it.
Do you have a follow-up question, Ms. Angel?
Nope.
Okay. Okay, any other questions for Mr. Taylor? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Taylor, for joining us today. Actually, you may want to stay online in case there are some additional questions.
Okay, I will do that.
Okay, Mr. Pulaski, you want to come back?
Mr. Chairman, I was also here to testify. I don't know if they told you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't have you on the list. Who?
Paul Michelson out of Anchorage.
Okay, Mr. Michelson, why don't you go ahead, sir? I'm sorry, I didn't have you on the list.
No problem. I called in. I got here, I thought, on time. My name is Paul Michelson. I'm also a builder in the Anchorage area. I happen currently sit on the... I'm a member of the MOA Board of Appeals and Adjustments for the City of Anchorage. I sit on three subcommittees that are all code-related for the National Association of Home Builders, and I sit on the main body, the Construction Codes and Standards Committee for the National Association of Home Builders, half of 7 years. And I chaired the last IRC Code Review Committee. The IRC is the International Residential Code Review Committee, and I chaired it the last go-around, the 2003 code body, and I also chaired it two previous code bodies and was a member of it for the last five code bodies. That being said, I have to agree with what Mr. Taylor stated. The gentleman before that, I'm sorry I forgot his name, indicated about shear walls and hold downs and stud placement and nail emplacement. Most of the buildings and structures, the three-story or single one and two family dwellings, I should use, say, are drawn and designed by designers, which are, some of them are AIBD rated, some of them are not. The designers then have the ability and right, as it stands right now, to self-engineer the buildings, as Mr. Taylor stated. Then it then goes down to the municipality of Anchorage and has gone through the plan review committee. We are all informed and told by the designers where the shear walls will be placed, where the nailing will be placed, and the amount of nailing. When a designer does not have the ability or feel that he has the ability, then he self-elects to go to an engineer if he wishes to, and that's something that's discussed between the contractors entering into the contract with the designer or not. I can't speak for Fairbanks and Juneau. I have built in the Valley several projects, and we follow the same guidelines in the Valley that we do in Anchorage, so I don't know if the Valley's suffering as much as some people would like to think. I don't think allowing self-engineering for three stories is going to be detrimental or dangerous to the public. I think that's all I have to say for now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. So you're not sure how this would affect the folks in Fairbanks or Juneau and other parts of the state? You can only pretty much speak for the South Central Anchorage and the Valley.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, we do have a question, Representative Chenault.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and I sure don't want to speak for any of the other municipalities, but I would assume if they have building codes that they're following one of these codes. And so I would assume that any municipality that has building codes, built to those codes, what this doesn't affect is any municipality or any area outside these municipalities. So I would assume that this would bring in line with the two different codes that you're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, was that question directed to me?
It's probably more of a statement than a comment, but if you'd like to comment would be great.
If I could, sir, with pleasure of the committee. The way the IRC was developed, it was developed years ago to, I don't know if most of you are familiar, but we had several codes. We had UBC, we had CABO, we had Southern Building Code, I think there was four or five of them. They all got together and tried to come up with a common code that would work for the entire United States. They actually called it an international code, and they tried to get Australia, Japan, and Canada in on it, too. And you can just imagine what Canada told us. But with this being said, most of the jurisdictions that adopt the code, they adopt the body of the IRC. And the IRC code, International Residential Code, and the IBC, International Building Code, have provisions that allow you to build a three-story building under their code by. So they have provisions in there that take in the safety of the occupants of the building. Does that help you?
Right, but that is only in municipalities that would adopt either the IBC or the IRC, correct?
That is correct statement, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, maybe the sponsor knows, is this current law being enforced?
Good question. Mr. Pulaski?
Through the chair, I'd answer first that the specific reference you were alluding to earlier, that you can build your own home and don't have to do any consultation with a design engineer, is page 2, line 13 or 14. So whether it's enforced or not, I have no idea. But the people that build their own homes don't have to go through the same process. It's only when you get outside of your own home. Who enforces it? As I understand right now, the fire marshal is the only one in the state that has adopted a general code by which they have practiced, but how much enforcement the fire marshal has as a capability, I don't have the first clue.
Thank you.
If I may add, though, one more thing, Mr. Chairman. Talking to the building community, in the areas that have a code and a plan review process, it is very strictly enforced. So.
Very good. Any other questions for either one, any of the folks online or here?
That good. Representative Petula?
Well, I think that maybe we have Mr. Stone from CBG. I don't know. Is he planning to testify? No. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm on Harper's.
Okay. Thank you.
He's here for another reason. Fair. Okay. Okay. Mr. Pulaski, anything else to add? You've heard from three folks to testify had some questions. Anything that we're leaving out?
For Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there is, unless there's a desire to address one issue or another. I can speak to a specific issue.
Okay. Representative Stoltz? Sure.
Okay, Mr. Pulaski, I see absent here. I see the affected professional community that has an interest in this. I don't reflect on the public safety concern, but I see an absence of letters from municipalities, from the building inspectors and the fire marshals and all the folks that we would expect to have concerns about this type of bill, not in our files. Is that
through the?
Is that have they had a comment on this or? What if, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz. It's a very good question, and we have asked each of the affected groups for an answer and made them aware of the bill and have not received a comment one way or the other from any of them, but it's not for lack of asking. And how you interpret that, I'm not sure. I mean, I can offer you my interpretation of what they've said, but that's unfair to them, too.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, could we possibly have our first witness come back up for a specific question?
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Morse? Question for Mr. Morse?
My question is, if you're going to go back and go through plan reviews, I'm sorry, I don't know all that entails, but if you're having engineers and architects look at the plan review, then doesn't that meet the safety requirement that you were concerned by? I mean, I can understand it if the person isn't having any kind of review, but as long as you're getting that kind of review and you're working with someone, does that cover the safety issue then about the three stories?
If the person performing the plan review has the expertise that the second gentleman on the phone referred to, where sometimes people, if they're designing even a single story or a two story home and they don't feel they have the expertise, they refer to someone who does. If the person doing the plan review has that expertise and then they can run those calculations and they can double check whatever the design is showing, then you've got the safety net that you're looking for. The problem that you run into is that the loads, the complexity of the structure and how you move for example, a wind loading that hits the top of a building and how that wind loading is transferred down through the structure all the way down to the foundation, it gets a lot more complex when you go up vertically. And so unless the person has that expertise, you don't have any hope that you're getting that level of safety. The state has a method by registering structural engineers as qualified to run those calculations. So if you've got a registered structural engineer on your plan review staff that can go through and do those checks for you, then you're fine. If you don't, then you're not. I'm aware of municipalities in the state that do not have that type of an area of expertise. So it's difficult. Something that you have to be careful with building codes is that building codes require a lot of things, and they're all there for the interests of public safety. But if you don't know how to run the calculations, if you can't do the math, if you can't figure out how the loads are transferred through the structure, then you're still vulnerable, even if you are building to a code. That's why we require the professionals to do the designs in all the different disciplines. All the designs that I do, they all have to meet the National Electrical Code. But just having a National Electrical Code book and going to work and wiring a building doesn't mean that it's going to be done safely. So the code by itself is not enough. You've got to have someone with that expertise. And the municipalities that I have been in contact with in this geographic area, I haven't found one with a registered structural engineer on staff. That doesn't mean that people on staff haven't been trained in other ways to do those numbers. We just have no way of knowing. But our statute has the requirements for that training in it.
Thank you.
Okay, I think
Mr. Chairman, this is Paul Michelson, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Michelson,
is it proper protocol to comment on that last statement or to add something?
If not,
I'll be quiet.
Go ahead.
What I want to say, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, most jurisdictions that I know of outside of the Anchorage and Fairbanks and you know, whereas most lending institutions require that their structure have an ICBO certified inspector to inspect their jobs, and the 6 or 8 ICBO inspectors that I know of, if they have any question on a plan at all, they will insist that the supplier of the plan get the proper engineering anyway. So it's going to be a fail-safe situation anyway. I don't believe it's going to slip through the cracks. Some small house in, I don't know, Houston or Bethel may, but I don't believe so. If that helps.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay, seeing none. I guess trying to think here. It's, you know, I'm a little uneasy about passing this or asking the committee to pass this out with your objections there. I'd like to maybe have Mike and I work with you. I don't know if you're available this afternoon. I think, Mike, you're available, aren't you?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
You sent me a note on a possible amendment that might appease Mr. Morrison and his organization a little bit more. So why don't we just go ahead and set this aside and bring it back tomorrow with potentially an amendment. Anything, Representative Stoltz?
Well, just on the issue, just with all the additional costs of trying to be that homeowner and grasp that American dream, increasing assessment, increasing property taxes, and adding another on a $200,000 house is basic living, and you're talking an extra $6,000 here. It's roll that in with that cost. I sure want absolute assurance that this is truly a public safety issue and not an industry or profession protection bill. And that's this is a bottom line. I look at the consumer concern as a consumer trying to afford a house. That's a pretty basic human instinct, and I want to do everything to foster that. And with all due respect to your profession.
Okay.
Representative Hall, comment? Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
In
Having heard the arguments, I would just like to relate a story that happened to me, because I think it changes your complexion. I bought a home that did not have a vapor barrier in the middle of Fairbanks. Can you imagine? At 60 below, my home, sitting on my couch, was 52 degrees. Didn't know that. Didn't know it when I bought the home. It cost me $90,000 in attorney fees for a $26,000 fix, which at the end of the two-year period, the people that I sued because they misinformed me spent $250,000 for their attorney fees, and we both walked away paying both of our attorneys. So I understand the American dream. I also understand the concerns that I would have, and I think everybody would have, in terms of saying, look, I don't want to buy a pig in a poke, and we don't want the seismic activity to be such in this country. We have a country here where we have a lot of seismic activity in different places, Anchorage included, Valdez, Fairbanks. I mean, we have a lot of things that have a potential, and I think if you get over three stories, I'm somewhat concerned that people are building those homes out of their own in areas where they aren't protected by codes. In Fairbanks, we don't have a building inspector, for example, outside the city of Fairbanks. So we have 50,000 people that live in areas where we don't have a building inspector. Now, I understand that as you're saying that maybe the banks will make those requirements, and I think my good representative to the left of me here sits on a bank board, understands that we want to make sure that the bank is protected for its assets. But I would be every bit as much concerned that the people that are buying homes and transferring them back and forth are also equally given the opportunity to not buy a big enough home. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Okay, we'll take this up. Put this bill aside for the time being, and go on to some of these other bills. I think most of the people here are for. House Bill 312, Fetal Alcohol Syndrome Effects and Prevention. Okay, this is Representative Weirux. Again, I would like the sponsor to explain the bill, or sponsor staff, and we'll have folks here from Department of Health and Social Services also give us their take on the bill, as well as we'll take public testimony. I do want to hold this bill over, though. There are some fairly large fiscal notes that I think we need to work a little bit more on, and I've spoken to the sponsor about that. So with that, let's go right into
Let me start the introduction, sure. And then I hope we have some questions about the fiscal notes, because I certainly do. This bill started out as a fairly significant effort to try and address in a very serious manner the problem of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And it is a serious problem. Alaska is the worst state in the nation for that disorder, FASD. It's fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. We used to, in fact, before I started on this issue, we called it fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effect. But there's actually a spectrum of disorders of which those two are an element. The original bill had involuntary commitment provisions, taxation on the alcohol industry, requiring that inquiries may be made for any woman who was pregnant who was going to drink, and that presented not only legal problems, but very diplomatic ones to ask somebody if they were pregnant. So what the bill has evolved to the Finance Committee after several committee hearings is the bill before the committee, and there is at least one amendment that I'd have that I'd like to take up later in the process, and also discuss what these fiscal notes mean, and then I'd ask Jack Tupou to sort of take it from there after that very cursory introduction.
For the record, my name is Jacqueline Tupou, and I'm staff representative Bruce Weirock. As was indicated by my employer, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are a huge scourge to our society, and the most sad fact is that they're 100% preventable. If a woman doesn't drink when she's pregnant, and our child won't have FASDs. And it's the leading cause of mental retardation in the state of Alaska for our children. It also causes permanent birth defects. It retards brain function, arrested emotional and physical development. It causes poor behavior. Children with FASDs act out. They have many problems. To form facial features can be a problem. And they it harms their learning and their sleeping patterns. The list goes on and on. It's a plague to our society, particularly here in Alaska, with the rate that we have. It's really a big problem. In terms of cost to the state, I believe you have in front of you the information from the McDowell Group. They did a study late 2005 that indicated the state of Alaska pays $3.1 billion over a lifetime for a child with FASDs. So these are huge numbers. If you multiply that by the prevalence rate that they guessed, it gives you about $45 million a year that we pay for children and adults with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And those are all kind of costs. Those are judicial costs for adult and juvenile justice, health service costs, medical assistance, special ed. It's every department, it seems like, is affected by the cost of FASDs to the state of Alaska. So it's a huge problem, and like Representative Weirach indicated, this bill's gone through a little bit of metamorphosis since it was originally pre-filed, but the version in front of you does a couple things. I just want to explain what some of those are. The first thing, it requires a continuing education requirement or for the initial licensure for doctors and nurses so that they are receiving all the information that they need to. The department did a survey, and they asked all the different health care providers, do you think it's okay if a woman drinks, or when would it be safe for her to drink? Is it okay to have a couple drinks? And alarmingly, almost 50% of OBGYNs thought it might be okay for her to have a couple. So, you know, with the high prevalence that we have of FASDs to the state of Alaska and the high cost of it, we really thought that that needed to be addressed. So there's an educational component. The second thing, it also requires an educational campaign that targets schools and hospitals, so that those children early on can learn about the importance of FASDs. Right now we're seeing lots of cases of generational FAS, where the grandmother had it, the mother has it, and now the child. So it's a huge plague to our society. And finally, it sort of institutionalizes some things that the department is already doing for continuing education, training, and diagnosis, and providing services for those people with FASDs. It's a huge problem, just massive proportions, particularly here in the state of Alaska, so it obviously needs to be addressed, and we're really trying to introduce this legislation as a small step forward in addressing this huge problem that's 100% preventable. And with that, I'd be welcome to answer any questions.
Very good.
Thank you. Thibault, is that? Yes, thank you, Thibault. Any questions for Ms. Thibault or the sponsor?
Good job. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal notes on the bill, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fiscal notes. There were zero except for one, which was by Health Social Services.
Through the chair, there's 3 from Health and Social Services that have dollar amounts attached to them, and 4 fiscal notes from other departments. So 7 total that apply to the current version of the bill.
Okay. We'll take a look at those as we progress here. Thank you very much. Okay. So we do have some folks who would like to testify. And some of you, I think, are here for questions, and some actually want to testify. So if I call your name, just say you're here for questions. Diane Castro. Good afternoon, Diane.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Diane Castro. I'm the manager for Prevention Early Intervention Services with the Division of Behavioral Health. And
what?
Division of Behavioral Health within the Department of Health and Social Services. So I'm here today testifying for the department and would like to say that we do support this bill. As Ms. Tupou has outlined to you, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is a huge issue for the state of Alaska. Also, as she pointed out, all prenatal disabilities that result from prenatal exposure to alcohol are 100% preventable. If a woman does not drink during pregnancy, then there is no damage to the developing fetus. With that said, it is also not as easy to prevent FASD as just saying, well, don't drink during pregnancy, because there are a lot of other issues that are tied in with that. Again, one that Ms. Tupou mentioned is that we still have a belief that drinking during pregnancy is acceptable and okay under certain circumstances, certain amounts of alcohol, during certain trimesters. We have certainly been working very hard over the last 8 years to really take away that belief and let people know that, in our opinion, drinking during pregnancy is not okay at any time, any amount, by anyone. So that is the position of the Department of Health and Social Services, no alcohol during pregnancy at all. But we do have to realize that there are still medical providers who do occasionally tell women, well, it's okay to drink in moderation, it's okay to drink occasionally, it's okay to drink later in your pregnancy. But the reality is the brain, which is the part of the developing fetus that is most impacted by alcohol, develops throughout the entire pregnancy. So there is no safe time to drink alcohol. So a lot of what we're talking about and what this bill addresses is trying to make sure that we all have the same understanding about the impacts of alcohol during pregnancy, that we are all saying the same message that during pregnancy we should not have, women should not drink alcohol, and then how do we get to that point where people are not drinking alcohol during pregnancy. So with that said, again, the department supports this bill. We feel it is a great building block to continue work that has already been done in this area. While we have been working very hard over the last 8 years as a result of actually an initiative that began back in 1997 with former Commissioner Karen Perdue, with Representative Reggie Jewell, and then Representative Fred Dyson, we have made a lot of progress, but I will tell you, we're not there yet. We're working on it, but we're not there. One of the things that we are looking at right now, as Ms. Tupou mentioned, 5 years ago, we did a knowledge, attitude, beliefs, and behavior survey. We did it for medical providers. We did it for social workers, correctional officers, educators, the general public, there's somebody else, substance abuse counselors. We are redoing that survey right now. Actually, the surveys are going out in the next 2 weeks, and we're going to hopefully then see what difference we have made over the past 5 years, and if we're getting closer to having at least started changing attitudes, and whether we've actually started changing the actual behaviors yet will be left to be seen. But I certainly could go through the bill and talk about the things that we feel are important. Certainly the training is a huge issue. We have been working very hard on training. Again, we're not there yet. We've done quite a bit of training. We've developed some curricula through the department that we're currently providing to service providers around the state. We have some certified trainers who are out there providing trainings. But again, there is a lot of continuing training that needs to be done. But our belief is, and our belief from the beginning of this project is, that we wanted to build in and address fetal alcohol spectrum disorder within the existing service delivery system. We did not want to build a whole system that was separate, that just dealt with this issue and in a separate way. We wanted to build it into the existing service delivery systems that are already working with these populations, with our schools, with our social workers, with our substance abuse counselors, all of those systems that are currently in place. So we've really been working to address and work within the existing system so we can build capacity to start working on this issue. We also have a number of diagnostic teams that are currently functioning, that have been building over the past 8 years. I have brought some copies of things if anyone is interested, some of the brochures we have developed, a listing of all the diagnostic teams so you know where they are located. And we also, this past year, as we were ending a five-year federal project, we held a series of regional summits around the state. We had one in Southwest region, Northern region, South Central, and Southeast, to ask the community, ask people what they felt the needs were. And I have the final report from those summits as well. And what I would say is this bill very closely aligns with what people in the public were saying about the needs that need to continue happening in terms of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Final thing that I'd like to say is that we see FASD as kind of a two-pronged approach. We need to definitely deal with the prevention issues. This is preventable, but it's going to take a lot of work to make sure we're really moving in prevention because we're dealing with a couple of different populations. We're dealing with people who just don't know that it's not okay to drink, and once you give them the education, they don't drink during pregnancy. But then we have those who already have a serious addiction to alcohol, and that's a much tougher area to deal with, and we really need to put some effort in there. But then the other part of it is, even though this is preventable, we are having a number of births every day, every month, that are impacted by prenatal exposure, and we need to make sure that we have services in place to help those individuals and the families of those individuals meet their full potential and provide them with early intervention, early services, so that they can progress and be fully functioning adults. I think it's very appropriate that we are hearing this bill today as the Key Campaign is in town, which is helping all of us have better understanding of the disabilities that affect the state of Alaska. That is all I will say, but I'm very happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay. Thank you very much. We do have some questions. We'll start with Representative Kelly, Representative Holm, and then Representative Chenault.
Just curious, since this is so impactful on Alaska, and since in some cases you could almost say it would be as you know, we put a mother in jail who'd run over her kid's legs with a truck, and this $3 million a copy, this is killing us, and not counting the human damage. Are any of the 50 states that are treating this in a judicial fashion and saying, you know, if you did that to your kid after birth, you'd be put in jail for it. Is there anybody that's doing any of that, or we have any impact in other areas where they've tried anything other than what we're doing, which is just, it keeps on and on and on, and we pay and we pay and we pay?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, a few states have looked at those issues, and as Representative Wyrock mentioned, that was one of the first focuses of this bill. What some of the other states have actually found, and I do serve on a national FASD steering committee, so I have a lot of contact with other states and hear what their experiences have been, is that what they found is many of the women who have the serious alcohol problems that really need some direct intervention are not looking for services. They have started going, they're not coming for prenatal care, they're not going to get the services they need. So what they found is, in some ways, it has backfired and has actually made the situation worse. So the women that were going and who had a substance abuse problem, who got pregnant and went and said, I need help, because there was this penalty, this potential of arrest or child endangerment, they stopped seeking services. So, you know, I think there's a balance that we need to find, that alcohol can be a serious addiction. And if you talk to any women who are birth mothers of children with an FASD, and you talk to them after they've become clean and sober, you know, they say, the last thing I wanted to do was hurt my child. But at the time, my addiction was so intense and took over that I was unable to make a decision. So, you know, a lot of what we try to do and what we have been trying to do for the last few years is to help other people outside of the person who's drinking, when she gets pregnant, for them to intervene and to try to help that woman get the services that she needs. There are substance abuse treatment programs specifically for pregnant women. We have a number of them in the state. Women, pregnant women have a priority for substance abuse treatment. So I think we're trying to deal with it in a more positive way to try to get the woman the help, so that the other reality is if you just deal with it at that time and don't deal with the addiction and the substance abuse, she will get pregnant again. So we really want to stop it, fully stop it now, so that at down the road there will not be additional births.
Thank you.
Representative Holm, to follow, sir, go ahead.
Is there any program where a person who is actually restrained or kept forcibly clean during the remainder of the pregnancy, where this person is known to be I know the impact on the system and everything, but at $3 million a copy and the human carnage that we're doing here, is there anything in the way of not waiting until after it happens, but intervening, any of that in any of the 50 states working?
Through the chair. Intervening before the woman gets pregnant? Is that what you're talking about?
The judge says that you're pregnant and you're drinking, or it's the second time around or the third time around, putting you away for 9 months.
So, again, that would be involuntary commitment
right.
type thing. And, again, there are a few states that have looked at that, and it, you know, I think, again, some of the same problems have followed that method, that a lot of women then go underground and don't go for services. But I also think that, you know, in the state of Alaska, we do have an involuntary commitment statute. So that if there is someone who's drinking to the point of hurting themselves or hurting others, family members can go through courts to look for involuntary commitment. So we do have that statute in place. I don't know how often it's used, and I think it's a little onerous, perhaps. But it is there so that for those severe cases that it can be looked at.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Holt.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, and they kind of dovetail with Representative Kelly's question. As a percent of our population, where does Alaska rank in the United States with FAS per 100,000?
Through the chair, that's an excellent question, and I wish I could give you an excellent answer. Unfortunately, Alaska is one of the few states that is currently keeping really good data on this issue. So when we say we have the number one rate of FASD in the nation, it's among those states that are collecting data, and many of our states are not. We are a state that is very fortunate that does have a birth defects registry system. I believe there's about 40 states in the nation that have those. And on top of the birth defects registry, we have had an opportunity to do some specific looking at pulling out some specific data related to those births that are impacted by prenatal exposure to alcohol. So we have excellent data. What we do have is there was a five-state study from about 1997 through 2003, I believe, somewhere in there. And among the five states, and I should have written down the five states, New York, Wisconsin, New Mexico, and I don't remember the other one, and then Alaska, we were significantly higher. I believe the next highest state was 0.8 births per 1,000. We are currently at 1.6 per 1,000 live births. And let me also just clarify that is for full fetal alcohol syndrome, which is currently in the state of Alaska, as well as nationwide. And we actually have some excellent data from our diagnostic teams to show that this is true in Alaska. About 10% of those who are receiving a diagnosis have fetal alcohol syndrome, which is a medical diagnosis. About 85% have what is considered the other part of the spectrum, which is a disability related to prenatal exposure to alcohol, but it doesn't include all of the like facial features and things that qualify for a full FASD. So the FAS is about 10% of the overall impact of prenatal exposure to alcohol, and that holds nationally as well.
I thank you for that, and I knew, my wife being a school teacher for many years, how big of an impact it makes in our public education. But I'm very disturbed by this, and I'm disturbed by the laissez-faire attitude of the public health system in the state of Alaska with regards to this. We've known about this for many, many years. When you said a moment ago, if I heard you correctly, that we still don't have any data after 5 years of collecting data that's been compiled to find out exactly where these real problems are, I'm concerned that we're not addressing it from a public health standpoint and saying, look, as Representative Kelly said, I think you take one more step. You said that it's a completely, you have a choice either to get drunk or not. You also have a choice to get pregnant or not. And that's the choice to get pregnant or not. If somebody chooses to drink and have a child, would you support the idea that if they have a child with FAS that they would be forced to have birth control so that they would not have another child with FAS?
Through the chair, just let me respond to a couple of things you said. First of all, I'm not quite sure that you heard me correct when I said we don't have any data. We actually have a lot of data for the state of Alaska. Surveillance and prevalence data, we have probably the best data in the nation. We have states who are envious of our system. And so we do have data there. As far as the fact that it has been around for a long time and how much progress have we made, you're absolutely right. We're working, but there is still a lot to be done. So with that said, the other comment about birth control is contraception, I think, is a huge part of this overall picture, and it actually is included in the current version of the bill. It is also included in this current version of the bill to look at FASD from a public health standpoint, because you're absolutely right. What we need to do is to look at this from the perspective, again, of prevention, whatever that looks like, either not drinking or not getting pregnant, and then also looking at then how do we develop a picture to know where those high priority areas are, what are the characteristics that we need to start focusing our efforts on. And I think that currently we do have some very good data that is starting to drive the development of programs of where we want to focus our efforts. So would the department support mandatory contraception? Probably not mandatory. We certainly believe contraception is an important thing to have access to, but then you get into the civil rights of mandatory or enforced contraception. But I certainly support women having access to contraception, and particularly women who do have a substance abuse problem and need to have access to that.
I guess the data that I was was alluding to is the data that you said that you were trying to keep records as to whether or not the numbers of whether you have an increase or a decrease or whatever. You don't have the data that says that since we've been collecting this data that we've either through our activities we've either lowered the number or we've got an increase. What is the public health, the behavior of public health, division of behavior of public health doing to mitigate the number of people that are in the system with FAS presently? That shows any, do you have any data that shows us that through your activities there's been any decrease or increase?
Through the chair, what we right now are seeing is that we, and which we expected to see from, can I just give a little context of time?
Sure.
In January of 1998, at the request of Commissioner Karen Perdue, I became the office of FAS. It was a one-person office, and basically she said, I want you to go out, figure out what the issues are, figure out what the needs are, and do something. That was my job description. Go forward, make something happen. At that time, we started, looking at what the issues were, what data did we have, what didn't we have, did we need to continue this effort and to get something off the ground. One of the things that we've seen through the data, and again this is through the birth defects and FAS registry, is that we have seen an increase in reports to the birth defects registry. What we found in 1998 is that even though ICD-9 code 70, that I can't remember, but it's prenatal exposure to alcohol, that it was not being reported very regularly. Not because people didn't realize they should be reporting, but because these were individuals who usually did not have a diagnosis, because we didn't have any diagnostic services in town, or in the state. So what we have now done, as we've increased our ability to diagnose this disability, and we've increased education among medical providers of when they should be reporting this to the birth defects registry, we have seen an increase in reports, which is a good thing, but it's also made our data look like it's increasing. But my belief is it's just the reporting that has increased. It's not the actual data or the actual incidence has increased. What I believe we will see is we will start seeing through this collection of data, and that's why it's so important that we continue to collect it so we know if it makes a difference, is that we'll eventually, as our public education campaigns, as we educate doctors about giving women information to not drink during pregnancy, as we educate families about how you can intervene with a woman who's drinking, that we will then start seeing a decline in the birth rate. At this point in time, the data that we have, I believe, and I believe Dr. Brad Gessner is online to testify from public health, is that correct? Or someone? Did I see?
Yes.
So he could probably answer some of these more specifically. But what I think that right now our birth defects registry data is only gone through birth year 1998, which is just when our big media campaign was starting. So as we then start abstracting data for birth years 99, 2000, 2001, and on, that's where I think we'll start seeing a decline in the number of births that are affected by prenatal exposure to alcohol. But I think it's perfectly natural and expected that we would see an increase in reports, not necessarily an increase in the number, but just the reports. So we're getting better data right now. Does that answer your question?
Well, excuse me, Chairman, just like follow up, and then I'll let go because I don't know that you've got the answer, but
I might not.
But I'm a little frustrated in the sense that we've known this since, and you've been on board since 1998, and yet you don't have the data that shows that any significant reductions have been made since 1998, since you've been on board with FES, and that it does no good just to collect data. The process I could care less about. The results I want is less people having FAS in the state. So what are you doing to make sure that people have less FAS in the state? If we're saying, and what can we do to help you do that? If early intervention doesn't mean anything, if it doesn't stop the process, and you know there's only two reasons that people have, they either drink or they get pregnant.
Right.
If we stop one or the other, we're not gonna have a problem. So what can we do to help you not collect data? I could care less about data or process or any of that. We do way too much process here. So how can we incentivize people not to have this activity? And if, in fact, as Representative Kelly says, maybe we should have some mandatory incarceration or something else. Maybe that's a better way to do it than it is to just go out there and have nice television commercials. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair.
Briefly, if you can, please.
Briefly, okay. Sorry. I'm passionate about this issue.
I understand.
I think we've done a lot, actually, because I think what we have done is through raising awareness, there are fewer women drinking during pregnancy. I will tell you, when I started in 1998, there was still a norm that it was okay to drink during pregnancy, and women who did not have a substance abuse problem were drinking during pregnancy because their doctor said it was okay, or their mother said it was okay, or those kind of things. We have now changed that norm among that population, those who don't have a drinking problem. We are now working more intensely with those that have substance abuse problems. One of the problems we have in the state of Alaska, and I know this is an ongoing issue, is treatment for women. A study that we had a couple of years ago, and I don't have the most current data, showed 40% of women with a substance abuse problem who wanted treatment, these were women who wanted to go into treatment, could not get treatment because there wasn't a treatment bed available for them. So if we are going to have early intervention, is we really need to be reaching these women with substance abuse problems before they get pregnant, and start getting them the services they need to deal with their addiction, with their alcohol problem, with their alcohol addiction, their alcoholism, so that if they get pregnant down the road, they will not be drinking. It, like you said, it's a little late to start after they're pregnant, because damage will already be done. So we really need to be finding and making sure there are services available to women who need substance abuse treatment early on, before they become pregnant. We also need better access, I believe, to contraception.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you, Mr.
Yeah. I think we're starting to repeat ourselves here a little bit. Okay, and Representative Chenault, you have some questions on the fiscal note, but since we're bringing this back up, we'll deal with those later. Okay.
Representative Stokes?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I might add.
This is
the sponsor might be helpful on this. I mean, go through the other committees. And I know the notice the bill artfully doesn't the intended beneficiary of this bill is the unborn child. Artfully, that term is never mentioned, and it's. It's, I'm just wondering, the Judiciary Committee, I didn't look at the minutes, was there any, we run into some, of course, the Supreme Court decision on the matter, whether or not to even recognize that's being, you get into that whole argument, can you really enforce a law that, as Representative Paul mentioned, putting people in jail is one, or some of the extreme measures you might need to actually clamp down on this. How much can we actually really do to, and I agree with the representative from Fairbanks that the public education only goes so far, but how much can we actually do to those that have a disregard for human life other than their own, and even little regard for their own as excessive drinkers?
Well, it did go through Judiciary's way because the provisions that people call offending provisions were removed. So we can get into that. And since I asked the chair to hold the bill so we could get testimony on this right now, I'll be glad to chat with you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate that, Tim. I think it's a fundamental issue that.
Okay, good. Well, let's work with the sponsor on this. I do have several people online to testify on the Municipal Harbor Facility grants, and we're just not going to get to that today. So rather than keeping people online to testify on that, let's plan on bringing that up tomorrow. And Ian, I see you're here probably for the sponsor, Representative Thomas.
Yes, sir.
Okay. If you could have Mr. Representative Thomas get with Representative Weirach. Representative Weirach had some questions and concerns that maybe we can deal with those prior to the hearing tomorrow. Okay? Very good. So if you're here for House Bill 478, we'll take that up tomorrow. All right. Representative Jewell, did you have a final question?
Kind of a comment. One, must have been during the 80s or... Yeah, it had to be during the 80s when this kind of came up. I sat on the Alcohol and Drug Board, the advisory board, state of Alaska. FAS, didn't know what it was. Never heard of it. Had all kinds of questions. Then realized the magnitude of the problem. How do we get to it? And since that time, it's been kind of like a foot race. Start again, stop again. And it goes to people's level of understanding. But here's one of the big challenges that's being faced as a result of stopping and starting. You get going down a track, and if you know you're going to take a race to the finish line and you're ahead of everybody, and you stop running, the chances are you're going to lose. And my point is that as we're going down this road, we can never get comfortable, never get comfortable in ever feeling like we conquered this 100%. We always have to keep up the pressure on education and making sure that the public's there. And we have to do this with our eyes wide open. Because once we get to the point of feeling comfortable that we're making headway and we back off on the resources that we're putting into it, we're going to find ourselves right back here. And I understand where you're going, Representative Holmes. How do you stop those two things? And I think we know where we need to go in terms of areas of the state. But it's got to be constant and change come ever slowly. It took us a long time to get where we are today, and it's going to take us a long time to turn that corner back around. But we've got to be persistent on it, and we just can't let it go. And I think probably the most compelling testimony that I've heard is not the $3.1 million that it costs in an individual lifetime. it's the aggregate of that in a given year of what it costs us, and that's the $45 million. So if we're concerned about the 1.6, we're looking in the wrong direction, because this could be saving us a lot of money. And are there going to be needs for holding people, finding ways to see whether it works? Yeah, I think over time we're going to have to fine tune it. But by God, I think we need to get in there and make some movement down this road for the good of all of us.
Yeah. Is there a question in there?
Nope.
Okay. I think we all feel very passionate about this bill, so maybe we can keep our comments about the bill for later when we discuss the bill. If there's any questions here for Ms. Castro, that's what I go for. Representative Cattu?
I have a question. I think I understand the intent of the registry, and I know that there's going to be an amendment, but I just want to get it on the record because of fear about possible discrimination against the children, in particular that registry that lists information about children and the mothers, that's kept confidential, that's treated the same way as the registry for people with impairments. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Cattullo, that's correct. It's the information is very carefully guarded. The names of those individuals who are reported to the registry do not get released at all. It is all for aggregate data so we can track the problem, know how big the problem is, if there's changes in the problem, what the prevalence is, what the dynamics are of the disability.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for your testimony today. Okay, let's go on to Pastor Larry and Laura Roran. Roran? Help me with the last name there.
Roran.
Okay. Very good. Welcome.
Thank you.
My name is Laura Roran. I'm from Juneau. I wear several hats when it comes to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Two of the hats, I am a parent navigator on the Juneau FASD diagnostic team, and I'm an advocate, a passionate advocate, for persons with an FASD and their families.
I'm Larry Roran. I'm the pastor at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church, a church that has spent a lot of energy in working with marginalized people in our community. We fed 3,000 people from our food pantry, and this year so far we fed as many as we fed in 2000. That gives you an idea of the growing needs that are there. And we have an unconditional food pantry, and I relate to people because I have two marginalized children who have a fetal alcohol syndrome, or FASD. So there is much understanding, and as I relate and have been a chair of the Glory Hole Board for 6 years, I just see over and over again some of the implications because I see it through my own children. And so we are the parents of two adopted children with FASD.
We are here to discuss House Bill 312. We adopted our two children in the 1970s as infants and were told that they were healthy. As they got older, we discovered the painful, harsh, lifetime reality that they were both born with an FASD and that their disability was 100% preventable, invisible, and severe due to the brain damage caused by their birth mothers drinking alcohol during their pregnancies. Inside this picture book, which is full of soot and smoke from a fire in our church 2 weeks ago, and he'll talk about that, are pictures of our precious children, now 33 and 30 years old, and their children, because between them they have several children. They look healthy, but they are not, and for each smile in this book are probably 1,000 tears. And for everyone photographed, there's stories because of the tears are because of the FASD, you know. And behind each photograph is a story about FASD, and we have many of them we could tell, but we won't get into any of them today. So I will put this here, and if anybody wants to look at it sometime, you can. Larry's going to continue.
In my comments, I would like to compare our life with a church fire. I don't think that's ever been done before. And the relationship with FASD. 2 weeks ago, as we were heading to the church for early morning services, we saw fire trucks at our church. And so a shepherd of the valley sustained what initially was, we were told, was $60,000 in damage from the fire and so forth. If you drive by that church today, there is minimal damage. Unless you go in and look in front, you won't even see any damage. But there is great devastation inside. There was fire underneath that had been brewing for some time. All of the wiring in the center part of the building is destroyed. Tremendous smoke damage throughout every nook and cranny of the building. In our sanctuary today is most of the interior contents that we use in our ministry. They smell smoke, and they must be thrown away, even though many of them look like they're in good condition because of the permeating smoke. About 400,000 in damage, at least, is what is now projected. We have insurance to cover most of the damage. We have engineers, contractors, and cleaners who can repair the damage. The congregation and the pastor are, at least we're trying to be, resilient through this whole process. We have a community that supports us in this process. Then I look at my children. Our adult children suffer from severe foundation damage. Their brains have damaged wiring. In most cases, their exterior looks undamaged and or minimally damaged. They are not resilient. The supports are typically not there for them or for us. The community frequently treats them like damaged goods. The garbage dump that they frequently are taken to is the prison. Anything that can be done to prevent foundation damage and apply appropriate repairs are vital.
House Bill 312 is a very important bill. It's very important to us. It is about prevention, and remember, FAS is 100% preventable. Earlier intervention for people born with an FASD, education for professionals who can help prevent and intervene, and documentation. The lifetime cost is monumental. Even though our children live marginal lives, they live lives in poverty. We call them, though, our million-dollar babies, because so much money has been spent on their care, mostly inappropriate care due to the lack of knowledge and understanding of the well-meaning professionals who are providing for their care. If we could have had appropriate early diagnosis and intervention, as well as ongoing supports and treatment throughout their lives by people trained in FASD, and that means all professions, they could have become the contributing members of society they and we dreamed of them becoming. We are aging and we are exhausted and are petrified for what the future holds for them and others like them. We urge the passage of the bill as the first step in addressing the difficult realities of this preventable brain disorder. Both of our children have expressed extreme anger because of the effects alcohol has done to their lives. And we would like very much, and we've been trying to get our son to come and testify. I think it's very hard for him. But anyway, thank you for listening. We are deeply grateful to Representative Ryrock for sponsoring this bill. And we will be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Very good testimony. Both did an excellent job, and sorry to hear about the church.
That can be repaired.
That can be repaired, that's right. Your children hopefully are living good, productive lives.
No.
No. Well, that's why this bill is so important, and that's why your testimony is so important, so that we can prevent others like this.
And we are passing around your book, and we'll, I don't know if you need to leave.
We can wait.
Very good. Thank you so much for your testimony. Okay, Brad Geisner. Geisner?
I'm sorry. Wrong list. Rick?
Annalino.
How'd you say it?
Annalino. Okay. Very good. Good afternoon, Rick.
Good afternoon. Thank you. First of all, I want to thank Representative Weirach for submitting this bill. It's an excellent bill. I did bring a child with me to give testimony. And it's from a FAS star, often met. It's called the Invisible Kid with the Invisible Disability. FAS is physical disability. It's literally missing parts of your brain. It's physical. You can see how silly I act when I'm out in public. You can see how mature I am, especially when you compare me with kids my own age. You always notice that I get out of control and lose it when things get too much for me to handle. You can see how embarrassed I get when I can't control my behavior, how frustrated I get when I forget the rules again and again, and my anger when I get blamed for trouble over and over. You probably can, because you can see the feelings plastered on my face. You say I'm a problem. I'm not a problem. I have a problem. I have static encephalopathy. That means the doctor told me that means my brain damage won't go away, or won't get any worse, but it won't go away either. It is forever. Now, that little kid, when he grows up, his behavior probably is not going to be that significantly different. Developmental stages, people are stuck many times in much younger behavioral patterns. What happens, the result, is about 60% of individuals with FAS, such as this little boy, when they grow up, will end up in institutions such as prison, primarily, and mental health facilities, probably both, back and forth, which is what happens here. We know that Lemon Creek estimated from prenatal alcohol exposure, in terms of anecdotal evidence, about 50% of Lemon Creek here in Juneau, occupy incarcerated people, have been prenatal exposed to alcohol, 50%. It's estimated that almost 70% of the children in foster care, and it may be higher in Alaska, I don't know, also are affected by prenatal alcohol exposure in varying degrees. Most people don't know that the facial features, the thin lip, the smooth philtrum, the short palpebral features, that's FAS. But most people don't know that those only develop between the 18th and the 24th day of pregnancy. And so before that, a tremendous amount of damage can occur, and you miss those days, there's no facial features, they look very normal, they're like the church. I really feel this is more like a Katrina tragedy coming to Alaska. And are we going to deal with it or not? Are we going to invest in it? Are we going to get those dams up and stop that from happening? Or are we not going to invest in the foundation we've all been talking about? The most frightening thing about this, Dr. Ann Streisgut, University of Washington, Department of Epidemiology, she's spent 30 years in that field, and she's just retired recently at 80-some years old. What the data indicates is that the costs associated with all alcohol-related births are much higher than the estimated just for the individuals with FAS, which is all we've been talking about, is FAS. Individuals with FAE, which is fetal alcohol affected, is an old term, what is now referred to as fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, are more likely to develop secondary disabilities. That is like going to jail, dropping out of school, stealing, alcoholism, homelessness, sexual impropriety, so on. And they need more service than people with FAS who have the associated, like I said, facial dysmorphology I was describing earlier. For Alaska, the economic costs associated with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, the cost could be as much as, get ready, 80% higher than those that indicated with people with FAS. We're talking big. Let me tell you a little bit about my background. I work for the Tlingit and Haida tribes of Alaska. We're the lead agency for the Juneau FAS Diagnostic Clinic, all volunteer, largest. We have about 17 members, doctors, psychologists, occupational therapists, and speech and language pathologists. I'm also a member of an international FAS working group established in Geneva, Switzerland by an MOU between Health Canada and the U.S. Indian Health Service to study FAS in Aboriginal communities. Most people don't realize that the average person who has a child with FAS is 35 years old, white, and professional. News. The cost is phenomenal. We have Bring Our Children Home, that's going to come. 54% of the children out of state who are in custody are estimated. That's through the McDowell study. It's not the McDowell study. It's the Children and Youth Needs Assessment Profiles for Alaska Children and Youth in Need of Care. And 54% of that group on the outside in custody associated with prenatal exposure. And some of them have been diagnosed with FAS. This is big. This is big money we're talking about. Thank you for letting me testify. I'm also very passionate. People who have seen this, I've been a treatment director in Bethel. I've seen a lot of tragedy in this field. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Representative Holm?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your years of being involved with FAS, have you seen any reduction at all in the number, or do you feel that we're just treading water, or give me an idea of what
I feel like I'm in a deep, deep forest and I can't see the individual trees. It's bigger, it's so big, it's unbelievable.
Wow.
Canada has been involved for 20 years in this, and it's a very severe problem in Canada. And various Yukon and Alaska, by the way, have very, very high rates, much higher than and we're neighbors. 40 miles across the ice field, we're in Whitehorse. We work closely together, by the way, but our rates are very, very high in comparison to the rest of the country, and so it varies very much. They have a lot of more support services in place in Canada than we do in the United States, and certainly we have, as you're hearing, very little for women right here in either the support or in treatment services. So that's part of what we're seeing in the big picture of 20 years of Canadian experience. They understand support services are really the way to go with this. And I attend international, we go twice a year, we meet with quite a large international group. And Alaska can be very proud about what's happened. There are 6 voting members to the working group, international working group. 3 are from Alaska. So that's we're well represented because we have done well in being a leader in the United States. We're recognized as that.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. I know you're very impassioned by it. And I just want everybody to know that this is a very, very tough one on me, too. My wife, many, many nights, would come home and was crying, having to deal with some of these kids and not knowing what to do. And so if I sound like I'm a little frustrated by the system, believe me, I'm as frustrated as you are. And I suppose what I would like to see that we would do, or at least we'd hope that we would do, is figure out some way to stop this process, or at least slow it down, or get it going the other way where we can feel like we're making some progress. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't have anyone else signed up here in Juneau, so I'm going to go offline. And what I'd like to do, I'd like to go ahead and, these people have been waiting patiently to testify by teleconference. I'd like to go ahead and take their testimony, and then Representative Weirich will save this amendment for when we bring the bill back, which hopefully will be soon. So let's go ahead and go to Fairbanks and hear from Susanna Fiona Stewart Kemp. Susanna Fiona Stewart Kemp.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome.
Thank you. I want to thank all of you very much for having me on. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. First of all, I want to start by thanking Representative Weirich from the bottom of my heart for sponsoring this bill, and I wanted to thank Rick Iannolino for his impassioned testimony. You're a wonderful person, Rick, and Pastor Roram, Mrs. Roram, thank you also, and my sympathies to you. My name is Susanna Fiona Stewart Campbell. I live in Fairbanks. I'm speaking today as an adult with who has FASD. And I also should mention that I am a sexton at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church here in Fairbanks, where I work very closely with the Native population and see daily, firsthand, the profound tragedy that results on all levels throughout family that cuts through many generations of families as a result of the abuse of alcohol and FASD. I wanted to speak today in support of this bill, about which I too am very impassioned, because I am an FASD adult survivor. I use the term survivor because, having never been fully diagnosed and having only discovered within the last 3 years that in fact the root of my problems is exposure to alcohol while I was in the womb, I have struggled all my life to understand what besets me, the internal challenges and physical disabilities which have restrained me from success in the world. As well, without a diagnosis in full, I've only had a diagnosis in part, I have always been ineligible for services. This is a story repeated hundreds of times amongst FASD adults who are not diagnosed or who are improperly diagnosed through lack of understanding in the world in general. Even today, most people outside the world of FASD who do not deal closely with this physical birth defect misunderstand and misrepresent us. But most importantly, we don't fully understand ourselves. Last night, I attended a support group for parents of FASD children, which relies heavily upon governmental financial support. These children were all vastly different from one another, experiencing a very wide range and disparate cluster of challenges, from very low functioning and severely handicapped to artistically gifted, articulate, and very bright. Some, like me, are conundrums, highly gifted in some areas but profoundly challenged in others. Sometimes the term cookie cutter is used to apply to children who suffer from problems with FASD. But people with FASD are not cookie cutters, and neither are we cookies. We are not, as some misunderstandingly proclaim, half-baked. But, continue to the analogy, like we are indeed raw. We are very raw. We're deeply wounded and raw in our hearts, our spirits, and our souls. And we have all been many times burnt in a culture which largely still lacks compassion and understanding toward us. I don't necessarily promote diagnosis in the sense of labeling, and I'm not fully in agreement with any provisions within the bill which would in any way inhibit civil liberties. I don't necessarily believe FASD individuals need to be labeled or medicated or suppressed. On the contrary, I believe that God is our healer and our champion, and He has actually restored me and sustained me in many areas throughout my life. But I am a person who has never really been a good contributor to society. I have not led a rewarding life, and I've always lived either homeless or amongst the working poor, despite the fact that the part of my brain dealing with communications was preserved from being affected by the alcohol in the womb. In order to know how to pray for ourselves, in order to know where to turn for viable services, in order to know how to obtain healing and therapy, which will enable us to reach our highest potential and express our beauty and gifts in the world, we need to know what we labor against. And that is where FASD diagnostic teams, support groups, education for the public, and for those who suffer with this challenge are so important. The Bible says, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Without diagnosis, without support, how can we discover the truth of our own beauty and talents? We urgently need the FASD diagnostic teams to continue to receive funding and to be further underwritten. We urgently require continued funding for education for the public, because, just as a quick aside, many times what's perceived as acting out on the part of children with FASD is not so much something that is an issue arising within the child, but is a reaction to misunderstanding, discrimination, prejudice, and bullying that the child might be receiving from teachers, peers, and other family members. We urgently require continued funding for support and education for FASD children and adults, their teachers, caretakers, providers, and the public at large. It's imperative that funding be maintained and increased to ensure prevention so that mothers will not drink when pregnant. I thank you for sponsoring this bill, Representative Wyrock, and I thank you for ensuring that this financial support continues. I will leave a copy of this testimony for you, as well as a poem which I wrote. I believe that the poem, which has been shared with, in many FASD circles, illustrates the heart's cry of those with FASD who seek to be enabled to express their light within this world. Thank you for your time, and if there's time, I'd like to share the poem. Otherwise, I'll leave a copy with the office here in Fairbanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart-Campbell. You probably, they'll fax it down to the members since we're running short of time. I don't see any questions from the panel. Next, from Kiana, Jean Gerhart-Sirif.
Hi, thank you. Jean Gerhart-Sirif calling from Kiana. My husband and I are parents of six children with prenatal exposure to alcohol, and I'm testifying today on behalf of my children. We are both also retired teachers, and I've had a great deal of training in FASD. And I'd like to address the continuing need for services for individuals and families impacted by FASD. Although I have six children with prenatal exposure, only one of my children has been diagnosed. My children are bright. Some are exceptionally bright. They are capable and in need of support to be successful. My children range in ages from 6 to 18. All have different needs, most of which are not academic, and therefore are not addressed by the school system. My children have behavioral, social, processing, and language issues, which affect their ability to function successfully without support. My 7-year-old is bright and personable. She could also easily be one who does not succeed in the school system due to social and behavioral issues. Because of my knowledge, we provide consistency, stability, and those things that she needs. She needs more. My 18-year-old just came out of residential treatment. Until he was placed, we had no support services, except what my husband and I, his parents by choice, and service providers by default, could provide. My son has the potential to be a contributing member of society, a responsible parent, and a productive worker, but he needs support to reach his potential. Without supports in daily living skills, supported employment, and money management, he is at risk for dropping out of society, turning to drugs and alcohol to cope with frustration of failure, and becoming a statistic. Unless you personally deal with this issue on a daily basis, it is difficult to appreciate the impact on families, communities, and the state. I don't like giving voice to this possibility as a parent, but rather than contributing to society without services, I am reasonably sure that he will become a statistic. I also know that if he becomes a parent and he does not have support, his children are at risk for being exposed to prenatal exposure. I am here today to ask that you not let this happen to my son or any other children affected by prenatal exposure. If our children do not receive the services they need for success, the state will bear the cost of its failure. Our children will swell the ranks of drug and alcohol treatment programs, welfare roles, and our prison system. The services provided now will be returned to the state exponentially in the capacity of our children to be productive citizens, future workers, and parents of the next healthy generation. In Kiana, we have had a prevention grant, and I know somebody was asking about the, is it working? It is working. We have had a prevention grant for 3 years and have done healthy pregnancy support. We are now in the process of developing a celebration campaign, a healthy baby campaign, because most of our babies in Kiana have been born healthy. And I believe it is a result of the money that's been put in to prevention. but prevention also needs to include services and support. I want to thank you for taking the time for hearing the testimony from the people who are in the front line. I have spoken about two of my children. I have six, and each has different issues and different needs. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them, and I thank you again.
Thank you, Ms. Syraf. Any questions? Thank you very much. Next to Kara Nyquist from the Alaska Association of Homes for Children in Anchorage.
Main committee members, can you hear me okay?
Speak up a little bit, Ms. Nyquist.
Hi, everyone. This is Kara Nyquist from Anchorage. Some of you who may not be familiar with me, I've worked as an attorney in the Anchorage community, and in the last few years, I've focused on public interest issues, working for Covenant House, and now also representing the 19 residential providers throughout the state of Alaska that provide services to youth and children. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay, great. I want to make sure that it's clear on behalf of all of our agencies that the youth we serve, we predict that as many as 60% of the youth and children in our program suffer from FASD. I say we predict because there is not diagnoses for all of the youth we serve. We may be a leader in Alaska in the birth registry or collecting data on young youth or young children, but we are not at the point where we have adequate data on the teenagers that we have been serving in our program. And we're not at that point where we can look at the data and look at the outcomes of that data, because we're talking about a program that has never adequately been funded. For example, in Anchorage, only native teenage youth are even diagnosed. There is no funding for non-native youth. We also want to make sure it's clear that the youth we are serving that we predict have FASD are the youth coming back from out-of-state residential treatment programs. These are the youth in the foster care system, the kids aging out of the foster care system, the families on public assistance, the kids that are having behavioral problems in school, and the kids in the juvenile justice system. We support this legislation, and when the question that was raised earlier is, what can the legislature do? The legislature can adequately fund treatment programs. Prevention dollars are not feel-good dollars. They are dollars that we need to spend in order to stop complaining why the Department of Health and Social Services budget keeps increasing each year. It keeps increasing because we're not investing the dollars early on. Instead, we're spending millions of dollars to treat these families that are in crisis. We cannot focus on the choice that a young woman makes to get pregnant. We need to think about the reality that she can't even be at a point in her life when she can make a choice, because her family is probably in crisis. She's probably in crisis, and she's probably a teenager who's now pregnant in crisis and needs to decide whether or not she's going to use drugs or alcohol. The Katrina analogy was interesting, but I think the reality is that the crisis is already existing. We need to invest dollars in prevention. We need to invest dollars in actually diagnosing the youth in our state who actually have fetal alcohol syndrome, and that data that we don't even have yet. We are not even to that point where we can look at the data and decide what outcomes, whether the funding we're already spending is working, because there's not adequate funding. So we support House Bill 312, and we hope that it also is supported with adequate funding, because otherwise we're really not addressing this issue at the level we are, and it is a storm that we can address, but we need to put the adequate funding there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nyquist. Any questions? Seeing none. Next, we go to Anchorage for Michael Baldwin. Mr. Baldwin?
Yes, I'm here. My name is Michael Baldwin. I'm here today representing myself. I have been a behavioral health clinician, mental health therapist for the past 17 years, approaching 18, and I have a pretty extensive history advocating and working with individuals with prenatal alcohol exposure and other drug exposure in a number of different settings, ranging from schools, healthcare facilities, mental health, community mental health, the prison system, as well as growing up. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, born here in Anchorage, and raised with kids and friends who drug addicts. I think also part of my experience is I work with one of the regional diagnostic teams. And I have seen very closely the devastating impact of alcohol upon the family and the community. As has been said before, Alaska has the highest known rate. Not only in FAS and the fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, but a lot of the other problem areas that can easily be tied as, you know, consequences of prenatal alcohol exposure. The high suicide rate, domestic violence rate, and so on. The population and the kids and the adults that we're talking about are clearly at risk for these other issues. Continuing the momentum that's been built over the last 2 years by supporting this legislation is definitely an investment in the future. I think one of the previous testimonies was talking about investing in the future, and it's really vital for the health of our future generations and for our state. I think one of the things that I'm definitely, as you can tell, supportive of this bill. I think one of the things that I like about it is its emphasis on the public health. I think one of the members of the committee was talking about this being a public health issue, and I think that's definitely highlighted in this legislation. And I very much show this is a public health issue. I think one of the questions that I was hearing earlier is this working? And I think it is working. Part of a public health approach to addressing something as devastating as the fetal alcohol syndrome and the fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is it's changing a culture and changing a community's culture and beliefs about alcohol. And the mere fact that there are, on a daily basis, I don't have to always educate people, and people are out there and they are aware, but we need more and more people to be aware and have a greater understanding of that. We're talking about a systems change and a pretty, pretty intensive change that comes. And so I think it's early yet to tell ultimately, but I think with continued support through legislation such as this and funding, we can get the numbers, we can show that all of the interventions are taking place. There is research that shows down in the lower 48 that prevention dollars is impactful, and it does reduce later services, cost of services, and so on. And I think, like Representative Jewell said, we have to keep our eyes on this, and we always have to be mindful and watchful of this. And, with that, I think I'll just kind of bring it close and say I support the legislation, and I can't echo loudly enough the previous testimony from the parents, providers, and the individual from Fairbanks. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Baldwin. I don't see any questions from the committee, so we'll go on to Patricia Center from the Alaska Nurses Association in Anchorage.
My name is Patricia Center. I'm chair of the Legislative Committee for the Alaska Nurses Association, and I'm also a family nurse practitioner. I wanted to speak to the provisions in the bill that require physicians and nurses to receive training in FASD. I think I was one of the people that was advocating for this for two reasons. One is that we continue to have patients who say that their doctors told them, it was okay to drink while they were pregnant. It's here in Anchorage, and it's in present day, so the education hasn't quite caught up with them. The second part of that is that we also receive a lot of kids that I serve that have been misdiagnosed. And so I think oftentimes healthcare providers are not aware of the subtleties of FASD. They think it's those funny-looking kids who are mentally retarded, and as the testimony before you says, many of these kids are quite normal-looking, and they have good verbal skills, and people are not attuned to what their true disabilities may be. In the section on the nurse requirement, by the way, it says that training for nurse practitioners actually should include nurse midwives and direct entry nurse midwives as well. On the question about prevention and is it effective, we've had a small prevention grant going where I work. Dollar-wise, it's been very small compared to our total budget, but it has totally changed the way we provide services for our kids. I can say that since we instituted our prevention training, we train all teenagers because we figure either at some point they might will become pregnant themselves or they will be fathers of children, so we think it's important that they all find out about the effects of drinking prenatally. A lot of these kids that we give training to are, in fact, FASD affected themselves. We know that the kids that we have stay with us and we provide services with, they're very conscious of the need to abstain from alcohol, and I think we've been successful. The question's going to be now what happens with the next generation when a mother is affected and a child is not. But that's maybe a good thing, a transitional period here. I also want to point out that a lot of times women who drink secretly, a lot of alcoholics, you know, you don't know they're alcoholics until they develop severe medical complications. So the whole concept of we're going to solve this problem by, you know, incarcerating people that are visibly inebriated, certainly it's better for us to get a culture that says it is not acceptable for women to drink while they're pregnant. I'll tell you one story. I had one youth that told me that of her friends, if they see a pregnant woman that's drinking, they will physically attack her. And I thought, well, this is not quite what we had in mind. But at least it's becoming part of the general culture that people know that they should not drink while they're pregnant. And hopefully we will see, you know, 5-10 years from now, the results of our efforts.
Does that conclude your testimony, Ms. Senna?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow for House Bill 271, I guess. The last person is from Anchorage, Cheryl Scott from the Stone Soup Group.
Hi, this is Cheryl Scott. Thank you to the committee members for allowing us time to present on House Bill 312. I'm the parent of one of those funny-looking kids. I have a 19-year-old son who experiences fetal alcohol syndrome. He's known to be the third generation in his mother's family to experience prenatal alcohol exposure. The other members of his family died much earlier than they should have due to unresolved alcohol and substance abuse issues. She was dead at 25. Leaving three children and two births that were so affected, or two fetuses that were so affected by alcohol that they were not viable. She's a woman who fell through the cracks, lived down the street, didn't get the kind of support she needed that when she asked for it. When she did surface, there weren't beds available. We never met her in person, but there were a lot of stories that went along with her that people in the community knew about. She was a really high-needs person, and her son is as well. We were lucky enough to have him come into our lives, and he changed our lives because of his disability. I couldn't work when he was young because of his complex health care issues related to his prenatal exposure and his premature birth. Once he went to school full-time, I was lucky enough to get a job at the very beginning of the startup of the Stone Soup Group, which provides services to families around the state that have children with a broad range of special health care needs, not just fetal alcohol syndrome, but autism spectrum disorders, Down syndrome, behavioral health issues, chronic medical disorders, genetic disorders, you name it, we've probably worked with it. One of the things that I've been really excited about being involved with since the very beginning of the work with the state in 1997 is the whole area of development of FASD projects and programs across the board. I've been lucky enough to be the parent representative on many of the curriculum development committees And for the last 3.5 years, we've been involved with providing support to families around the state who are raising children with special health care needs, but particularly in that last 3.5 years, children with FASD. We also work with the providers that see those children on a regular basis. I think I average between 250 and 300 different family and service provider contacts, multiple contacts typically, either sharing resource information, arranging to do trainings for their staff or in their communities with churches, probation officers, youth treatment program staff, all across the community. What I see is that the families that have children that have the severe end of the spectrum, children like my son, who are so impaired that they qualify for developmental disability services, is that we do pretty well. Yes, our lives are really stressful because of all of the complicated health issues we deal with. But it's the families who can't access that kind of support, they can't get respite, they can't get in-home support or accommodations for their children in settings in the community. Those are the families that are really in crisis. Those are the families that I hear from every day in my job. So I do this as a parent on the weekends and in the evenings. I'm lucky enough to have a paid staff person that can work with my son, help him learn how to be out in the community, somebody that will always be there when his family members can't be, to ensure that he continues to stay safe and that he has the support and the assistance he needs to try to be a successful member of the community. He's never going to be able to do that without support. For me, the challenge is finding appropriate services and support and training for those families of the other 90% that can't get the kind of services my son can get. And it's a tragedy that because they don't physically look like there's something wrong, we as a community and as a society are prepared to say there isn't anything wrong with them, when in fact, when we can do an adequate diagnosis, we can define the areas that they need help in. The next step is providing those services so that we don't end up going down the roads that other families have talked about during this hearing. These are our families. This is our community. They are us. We just can't see them. We haven't opened our eyes, or our eyes aren't able to see them at this point. Like Jean said, from Kiana, there's some amazing things that have been happening over the last several years. A family camp that brings families together and provides training and support. Over the years, with different families that have continued to go to that camp, we've seen an increase in their resilience, their ability to work in a positive way with their children. Parents that came to the camp the first time, screaming and yelling and snatching at their kids, now we're using their words in a more gentle way. They aren't using physical discipline. They've learned how to cope with their children's special needs. And that's from being with other parents and from learning about their disability and finding out about what does work. That's a long process. It's not something that happens overnight. And so the time that we've put in since 1997, when we started looking at the issues and developing programs and searching the country for things that work, we've all been doing our damnedest to try to come up with strategies and interventions that are going to work, not just for children like mine, but for the 90% that look like there's absolutely nothing wrong with them at first glance. We've still got so much work to do in all the systems that our children impact and are impacted by. But primarily, I think, we really have a lot of work left to do with the Office of Children's Services for Children in Foster Care. Either before they go into care or after they become more to the state. We need to support their families and help their families understand what their children's needs are. We need social workers and their supervisors that understand their disability. The police, the judges doing sentencing, probation officers, juvenile and adult correction system, everybody that's involved in those services.
Thank you, Ms. Scott. We should get to a wrap-up point here.
Okay. Well, I'd really like to, again, thank the representative for developing this bill. This is just an amazing thing to see happen in our state, and I totally support where it's going. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe that covers all of the folks on teleconference, so that will close the public hearing and we'll lay this aside for the previously described additional work. Next meeting of the Finance Committee is March 16th at 1:30. On Thursday, the bills up are House Bill 176, elimination of daylight savings time; House Bill 271, limiting overtime for registered nurses; House Bill 441, therapeutic courts for DUI sentencing; Senate Bill 157, regulatory cost charges for utilities and pipelines. And there'll be a brief break after the bill. I believe the harbors facilities is going to be held over till the next meeting as well. And we're also going to start the public testimony on the operating budget at 4 o'clock, so there'll be a brief break after the regular bills. With that, anything else before the committee? We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.